God is with you.
Let us pray.
O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. A lot of the time when it comes to Jesus' parables, some of the impact is lost on us because our culture is so different from their culture. We lose some of the shock value. We don't realize how controversial of a statement Jesus is making when he, for instance, says that a Samaritan and not a Judean or a priest that is the one that comes to the injured man's aid. Because we forget just how hated Samaritans were by Judeans. It would be like Jesus telling a story today where the good guy also happens to run a drug cartel or be a member of a terrorist organization. Or let's look at the parable of the sower, where a farmer is seen planting his fields by just throwing seeds all over the place. Most of us aren't farmers, and pretty much no farmer plants seeds by hand these days, so we don't quite catch how bad of an idea, agriculturally speaking, that would be. A farmer at that time would take care to not waste any precious seeds and only plant them where they would have the best chance of flourishing. But the farmer of that parable just throws them willy-nilly without a care in the world as to where they land. Lesson being, share the good news absolutely everywhere to absolutely everyone, and don't worry about if the audience is worthy or receptive. But then there are parables like this one that still manage to be somewhat shocking even today. Can you imagine a pastor that you respect giving you the advice to just lie and cheat your boss when your debts come due? So Jesus, you're telling me I should commit fraud? As a try-hard from the way back, this parable and the advice it seems to contain on the surface makes me uncomfortable. Don't worry, though, just like with all of Jesus' parables, there are layers, there's depth to it. And I want to explore that depth with you all. Every commentator I've read about this passage, and I have read a lot of them over the past week or so, they start off their commentary by saying, this is a tough one, isn't it? And no commentary I've read has offered just one potential explanation. They all give options. So that's what we're doing today. We're exploring our options with this text and providing some helpful context and history along the way. And then given all those tools, it's up to you to figure out what to do with these words of Jesus. This parable starts off with an accusation which we never actually find out for sure is true or not. An accusation made against a person enslaved by a wealthy businessman and set to oversee the other people that he's enslaved. An accusation made by an anonymous third party. It's not exactly unheard of that servants would have the blame pinned on them for someone else's bad behavior. Perhaps some other guy who's in business with our protagonist's master is skimming off the top but doesn't want to be caught, so he'll pin the blame on the servant. Maybe the servant really is just kind of shady. You can't even draw a conclusion on whether or not the accusation was legit from his later actions. It's a well-known psychological phenomenon that people become what we insist they are. Children whose teachers believe in them significantly outperform children whose teachers assume they're bad students, even when they start out with the same baseline academic. Teenagers who are falsely accused of crime often go on to commit real crimes. It's demoralizing to be good and have people insist you aren't. So if people are going to think you're bad no matter what you do, you might as well just be bad. All of which to say, we don't know what this servant did or did not do before the story picks up. But either way, you know, in my mind, it's hard to be mad at someone who's being forced to work for no pay and for keeping a little bit of the profits for themselves. That, to me, is not a crime worth prosecuting. It's certainly a lesser crime than, say, enslaving somebody. Of course, his master doesn't see it that way. The servant is told, all right, bring me your ledger. And we're going to go over these numbers together, and if I catch a whiff of dishonesty, you're fired. Now, the servant's reaction is interesting. matter what he does at this point, he's probably done for. Or at least there's a very good chance. Even if he's actually been honest in his management, once someone with absolutely no social power is accused of something, that's pretty much it for them. That's often true today in our legal system, even though we hold innocent until proven guilty as a value and a standard. We all know it doesn't always actually work out that way, but back in the day when that wasn't even the standard, and the person on trial is enslaved, he barely has a chance of getting out of this with his job. And sure, it's a job that doesn't pay, but at least Master keeps a roof over his head and feeds him. At least he's in the house and not in the field. He could easily be demoted to physical labor, or worse, lose his place entirely and be forced to beg on the street. He truly has no good options. So he decides that he's going to use his last act in this position of relative authority to do a favor to every other slave owner his master is in business with. So that when the master inevitably kicks him out, he has a whole network of buddies to choose from who will want to repay his favor by offering him a management position with them. Quick aside here. This is a good plan to a point, and it's probably the best plan available to him, but if I were one of these other business people, I don't know that I'd be interested in having the guy who committed fraud on my behalf work for me. In my experience, if they'll lie for you, he'll lie to you, which is a thing I think Jesus addresses later on in this passage, and we'll get there when we get there, but I wanted to interject that while we're still on the servant's plan chapter of the story. Anyway, the servant puts his plan into action by going around to every businessman who owes his boss money and basically cooking the books, telling them, look, just pay this much instead, and I'll get out of your hair. And they do it. And having settled all of these debts, the enslaved man goes back to the big boss and shows him what he's done, and the big boss is delighted, which again, is pretty weird. You would think he'd be upset about this servant telling other businessmen that these debts are settled when they actually aren't, and it's not like he can give them a call and say, I know the guy that works for me told you we're square, but you actually still owe me 450 gallons of olive oil. That conversation would not go well. That would be the end of their business dealings, I promise you. So what is the manager so happy about? Again, there are a few options to consider. Some have theorized that the part of the debt the servant canceled was his commission, so he didn't actually dip into his master's profits. I guess that's a nice idea, but, okay, I mean no disrespect to anyone who's ever gotten a commentary published. I've never done that. That's a big deal. But that's not what's happening here. That is definitely not what's happening here. That's not really how master-slave relationships worked back in the day. They didn't make a commission. And even if they did, it would not be 50%. I mean, what the heck is this servant supposed to do with 450 gallons of olive oil? He doesn't have the infrastructure to move that much product. He doesn't have property to store that on. It's not his commission he's sacrificing. There is no commission. And it's those sorts of theories that come from the desire to make Jesus and his parables as inoffensive as possible. Well, the hero of the story can't do anything bad, so we have to figure out how to make his actions not bad. And then there's that little healthy dash of, let's pretend slavery never happened, and if it did, it wasn't really all that bad on top. So anyway, bad commentaries aside, you can take that theory and put it in a trash can somewhere. Other theories as to why the master is happy with the servant's actions are a lot more compelling. One theory is that there are these debts were hugely inflated. And the servant knew it, so the master is still making a profit, and now he actually has the money on hand. Another related one is that the other businessmen were not in a position to pay the debts as they stood. So the servant's actions served to settle debts that may have gone unsettled for a long time. So So again, a debt in the hand is worth two just sitting and drawing interest in the bush. My personal favorite theory, though, is that the master can't help but be impressed by the servant's actions, even though they actually are directly costing him. In spite of himself, he's impressed that this servant, whose intelligence was probably greatly underestimated, came up with a plan like this, a plan that will ensure that he has a place to go if and when this current master kicks him to the curb. Now again, we aren't really shown the end of the story. We don't know if the master keeps him around or not. But it really doesn't matter because he's going to be okay either way. And that's the story. That's the parable. Then we have the commentary Jesus himself gives afterwards to explain and apply it to his audience. The first thing he says is basically, we got to stop being dumber than the non-believers. We can be just as smart as anybody, and we can do it without sacrificing any of our integrity. We can do pretty much what this servant did, but in an above board kind of way. The bedrock advice here is make friends. Use the wealth you have to the benefit of the community. We don't all have to take a vow of poverty. Wealth isn't a bad thing. Bad things done in order to gain wealth are bad things. Stepping on other people in order to become wealthy is a bad thing. But the wealth itself is neutral. It's just a thing. Sure, this master and his servant may be shady, but the principles of their actions are solid. Have give and take relationships. Don't be afraid to call in favors. Be smart with your money. I don't know who needs to hear this today, but being a Christian is not an excuse to be stupid with money. Generous, yes. Stupid, no. And the best way to be smart with your money and have integrity all at the same time is to keep things in perspective. We serve God, and therefore so does our money. It is not and cannot be the other way around. We can't serve wealth and selfish interest and hope that God will somehow assist us in our conquest. We can't walk around with our socks on the outside of our shoes. You know, I know a lot of people that want nothing to do with the church anymore. And you know what their number one complaint is? It's not the way the church has mistreated LGBT folks, though that one does come up a lot. It's not specific stories of bad ministers. It's not even theological or philosophical differences. The number one thing I hear from people that don't want anything to do with the church anymore is that churches are really good at getting money out of vulnerable, lonely people and then not using it for anything worthwhile. I hear some version of that all the time. We aren't supposed to be people that pray for God to make us rich. We're supposed to pray that we would use whatever resources we have in a way that God would approve of. That's the message. It's not a stamp of approval for fraud. It's not an exact blueprint for how we should do business. It's a reminder that if we build a community where people take care of each other, and if we keep our perspective on money in its proper place, then we can use our resources to accomplish great things. Just as great as anyone who is doing shady and selfish things with their wealth. Jesus is saying we can keep up with the bad actors without compromising and becoming like them. God blesses wise decisions made with pure intentions. That is Jesus' message. We're to serve God, not ourselves. And we can do that with our wealth just as well as we can do that with any other gift that we've been given. I invite you to join.